Well, welcome to the Inspired Minds Podcast. My name is Jeff Watson. I am indeed your gracious and your grateful host. I did it. I've been trying to get that last bit out for the last six takes. This is my seventh one because my mouth is tired from speaking so much. My entire job now as a therapist is to talk, and I'm realizing now that less talking, more, how about this, less talking of me and then more of the upcoming interview that was fantastic. So this woman, Christina Lopez, coming up here in a few, and once I'm done, John, she was fantastic, great, great conversation. Associate editor over at a little publishing company called St. Martin's Press, kind of one, a big one there. And we talked a lot about, she's really big into rom-com is kind of what she kind of got her started. And just about what, how she finds stories and kind of how that works within that particular wheelhouse of rom-com. And we just talked a lot about volunteer work. She was just a really good human being. It was nice to talk to. And talking about the rom-com thing got me thinking. And like, I'm not the biggest rom-com fan in the world, but so be it. But I remember, actually, the only thing I'll talk about rom-coms is the movie The Apartment. Jack Lemmon. That's the, like, the ultimate rom-com. After that, Sleepless in Seattle or something. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm only amusing myself right now. I'm very, very sure of this. So that in mind, here comes the smart person, and that would be her, not me. Hope you enjoy this as much as I did making it, and hope we'll do this soon. Bye. Hello, welcome once again to the Inspired Minds Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen of the dazzled throng, please say hello to the lovely and talented Miss Christina Lopez. Say hello, Christina Lopez.
Hello.
Wonderful, wonderful to meet you. As I was describing to you earlier, and for the listening audience, I have a beautiful little five-year-old dog sitting next to me that I just adopted, a little sheltered dude named Junior. So I am in a good mood to begin with, but it's not about me. It's about you. So the first question is, same question I ask, as you may know, to every single person I interview. When you were young, what was the first thing that you can remember that truly lit you up? Was it a song or a book or a person or a poem? Something happened.
Yeah, I mean, maybe an unexpected answer since I work in publishing, but it was books. I've always loved to read since I can remember. I grew up, or I learned to read on Dr. Seuss books.
Oh, wow.
So I always like have fond memories of like One Fish, Two Fish, and yeah, sure. Hop on Pop.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, around the time I was in middle school, probably, I discovered Nicholas Sparks books. And it just sort of all happened after that. Like, I read through his whole list in about a year. And then I just kept reading after that really, really voraciously, I guess.
That was it. One Fish, Blue Fish, Red Fish. Wait, yeah. Hang on. Let me see if I can remember this. I know One Fish, Blue Fish, Red Fish, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. What's after that?
There you go. Honestly, I don't remember.
As far as it goes. That's wonderful. And Hop on Pop. I remember that one too. And That's the point of that question, right? It's a layup, because usually the second part of the question, the follow up, is like, oh, how did that get you to where you are now? Mm-hmm. Clearly.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. It's this idea that I have, it's something I do with my clients all the time and myself. It's this idea of having a North Star, right?
Yeah.
I tell people all the time, I'll say, this is, you know, the Vikings, how do they get across the Atlantic? They didn't use a sextant. They didn't use a compass. That didn't come to like 1100 in China. Mm-hmm. They traveled by the North Star. So when you find that North Star, it's going to guide you, and challenges, it'll be difficult for other people. You're going to be, have the strength to bat them away, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's really cool looking back now and kind of seeing the way it all aligned, because you can't tell when you're kind of going through school or college, and then I had a million ideas of what I wanted to do, but it's really cool once looking back, you can see like, oh, I actually did love reading this whole time, and that's why I'm here.
Absolutely, which actually kind of, I found this great quote of yours. I love this. I'm going to read it back to you. This is exactly what you're talking about. Before getting into the industry, I wish I knew how important knowing the books that you want to work on is. It sounds obvious, but it's a passion industry. So if you aren't passionate about the books you're working on or your boss is working on, your job won't be as meaningful.
Definitely.
Tell me more about that, please.
Yeah, well, I feel like when I was looking into going into the industry, I've never been a big classics reader. And so I was like, maybe that's bad. Like, does that make me a bad reader? but publishing is really just so niche and subjective. And so you have to find an imprint that does what excites you. Like, they're publishing books that you are excited to work on. And it doesn't necessarily have to be what you like to read, but you do have to be excited to work on these books because you're reading so many of them all the time. And so at St. Martin's, we do really fun books. Like, we're doing really commercial books. So a lot of book clubby things. My list is really like just fun rom-coms. And that's also what I like to read. So it makes the work worthwhile for me because I'm able to work on what I'd be maybe reading otherwise, you know?
1,000%. You bring up, the reason I call this out is because, as I mentioned before, I was in the music industry and I'm a huge music nerd. Like, it's all I know. I know way too much about dumb arcana or arcane information about music that nobody should know, right? And that's why it was a passion industry for me. It's why I was in the industry.
Yeah.
But I was shocked when I would meet these people and they're like, I don't really like music that much. Like, why are you here?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You must meet people like that. Yeah.
And I think my point too is just like, you don't have to, like, I'm sure the same with music, like, you don't have to know every song in existence to like be in music and to be passionate about it. And so I think going into the industry, I was like, well, I haven't read every single book, or like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know a lot about these sorts of books, but it really doesn't matter. Like, if you can show that you're passionate in whatever it is, if it's like historicals or rom-coms or thrillers, like, you're good as long as that's what you want to work on.
Absolutely. It's just always amazing to me when people had zero passion for, you know, for working in the industry. And speaking of which, well, speaking of the industry, so, you know, part of my job, I wasn't in what they call A&R, which is where you would sign bands, which sounds a bit like what you kind of do. You source material, correct?
Right.
Right. So as an A&R person, I wasn't doing that, but I knew friends who were, and they were constantly hit up. Right? Hey, I got a friend. I got a guy. He's got this music. He's got this tape. He's got this thing. And it was, my friends are always like, oh, okay. But also my friends had to be, in a sense, and I think you're going to resonate with, you may resonate with this. My friends were, in a sense, like, they were like hunting for songs, right? Like, they were like hunting, in a sense, for source material, right? But like hunting for music, hunting for art. And that's why I always kind of described it to them. I think that you're a story hunter in that context. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's, I think that's exactly what you do. I think that you are a story diviner, like a story shaman in a strange sense. I mean, I may be completely wrong about this, but it seems to me that from what you're describing, it does sound like that idea that you are finding stories and you're kind of like searching them out.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much part of the job, is just reading submissions and deciding what's good. And it's so subjective, right? So what's good to me might not be good to another editor, but it's deciding what you think is good, what makes a good book, and if this can be a good book. And then you have to have that like passion, and you have to explain it to everyone else to make them love this book, to prove that we can put money down on this and it'll be worthwhile.
Yep. You got to sell it. Yeah, absolutely.
You have to sell it.
Sorry to interrupt, but I have to ask this question. How many people come up to you and say, I have a book idea?
So many. It's hard because it's like, it doesn't really work that way. Like, you see publishing in a lot of media and you think like the editor is like this hotshot editor that just like can publish whatever, or, you know, it's like, and it's different in everything, but it really doesn't work that way. So it sucks because I'll have to be like, well, you do need an agent. And they're like, okay, but how do I get an agent? And so there's just so many hoops to jump through. But yeah, I have an uncle that's always like, is it really that hard to publish a book? Like, I feel like I can write one in like a few months and have it published. I'm like, not exactly.
No, that's not quite how it works. Or you can have it self-published on Amazon and have no one look at it whatsoever. So you
definitely can. Yeah. And it's funny because there's a lot of people that have self-published that make a ton of money, and they're now kind of looking for a more traditional publisher to work with because there's just I mean, there's pros and cons for every type of publishing.
Of course.
But I think being with a traditional publishing house, you get so much support that you wouldn't otherwise.
Well, and it's so funny. It actually dovetails really well into the music industry thing that I was in. By the way, this has been 10 years and all of a sudden my brain's lighting up about the music industry all of a sudden. Thank you. But it's actually, that's interesting. It's kind of the same business model actually. And just in that sense alone is that, again, you're finding, you're sourcing material as an A&R person, right?
Yeah.
You're going to go find the hip hop record, the whatever record, whatever's hot and cool. And they have their wheelhouses. One person's really into hip hop, the other, because he doesn't know shit about rock and vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. Same kind of business model is what it's sounding like. And yeah, it was the same thing too, because people would come to me sometimes and they'd say, I got a demo tape. And I'm like, get a lawyer.
Right. It's like, I can't do much for you.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about, you kind of resonated there about that idea about you being a divining rod for stories. Tell me why you think that's true.
That's funny. I don't know. I like how that sounds. I like the phrasing. But it feels that way sometimes with just, you get more as you go on your career, which obviously as I started acquiring about a year ago. And so when you start acquiring, I posted it on Twitter or you post it somewhere, you know, you kind of make it known that you're acquiring now.
Can you define acquiring, by the way?
It's a term. Yeah. So that means that I'm open to basically buying books. So agents can now email me with their submissions. And if I like it, I can put money down on it, basically. So you just make it known somehow that you are open. And then the emails just start pouring in. Like, I don't know how the agents learn about you, but they do. The word travels fast. And so immediately when I started acquiring, I had like 20 submissions in my inbox. And these are like full length novels, you know? And so the more you read these submissions, you start thinking like, what does a book actually sound like? Like, is this actually a good book? Am I losing it? Like, so it's just kind of like always recentering and reading something that is a published book and being like, okay, yes, I'm on the right track here. Or I've just simply been reading for way too long. So it does sort of feel like you're kind of mining for those good ideas or good writing. And it really is, it depends every submission. Like the writing can be fantastic on one submission, but it's not maybe quite right for our house, or I'm just not the best editor, or something didn't resonate. And so it's so subjective. So it's the fun part, but it's also the hard part, I think, about working as an editor.
What's the hard part?
Well, trusting yourself in that what you're reading and you think is good is actually good.
Wow.
Or also just being able to say no when you know it's not good, or if it's not good for you, or being able to phrase that, because I'm sure, you know, writers take forever on their books and they really put their heart into it. Writing is so, what's the word, intimate. And so it's hard to be like, I see this, but I didn't love it. So, you're giving more no's than you are giving yeses. So it's hard.
Okay. Here's the therapist question. I'm not going to charge, by the way. Here's the therapist. I might later. You can even throw more questions. Here's the question. It's really interesting, right? Because you do have to sort of learn how to trust your gut, right? And then, so the question, maybe the follow-up question is, how do you know when it's good? How about that for a question?
Yeah, it's such a hard question. It was the main question I had when I started my job. I was like asking my bosses, like, what is a good book? How do you know that it's good? And my boss said something that really stuck with me. And she was like, you're the only one that knows. Like, you decide that, and then you have to sell it. Like, you have to tell everyone why it's good. Like, only you know why you think it's good. And so it really is just like a skill that you have to sort of learn, because when I first started, you're not acquiring, you're just assisting. And so you get some exposure to submissions without having the stakes on you. And so that helps, because you can sort of see which books did get published or which we did offer on. And you're like, okay, I see why that was good or why it wasn't. And then sometimes you don't agree at all and something gets published. You're like, okay, cool. Or sometimes you think something is really great and they don't end up offering on it, or they don't like it. And you're like, okay, I guess. So it really is just a skill. I feel like it just takes a lot of practice to just trust yourself. And it's always scary. Like, so basically for us, when I do like a submission, let's say I have to take it to a general meeting for our imprint and pitch it and have people read and see what they think. And so that's always scary, because you're like, you have to really trust yourself to put it in front of all your colleagues and be like, I think you should take some time out of your day to read this because I really like it.
Correct.
So it's, I mean, it's fun, but it is just sort of a skill to know what's good. And it's so subjective. Like, there's really no answer to this is a good book. It's really subjective. And it depends on what you're looking for, what kind of books your house publishes.
Sure.
Yeah. And what resonates with you, really. Like, some people really love plot heavy books. So not too much character development, but the plot is really engaging. Or some people just really care about the characters, which is more where I'm at. And so I really need to care about the character before anything happens.
And as a, you know, we'll now coin this term, as a story shepherd, ooh, that's what you are. As a story shepherd, which I've now bequeathed unto you, it's got to be amazing to watch the sheep be herded. I don't know what that means yet, but you know what I mean? To finish off the project, because this is your thing. I know what this is because I've done it. I've done that for My Chemical Romance and a bunch of other bands, quite frankly, where it's like, this new band's going to be amazing. And I think they're fantastic. And this is why you got to double down on this band, because this is going to be great. And when you see that through, like I did, holy crap.
Oh, I know. I've been at my job for 2.5 years now. So I'm just seeing like a lot of the books that I worked on from the very beginning, going through the entire process, because it takes about a year for a book to be published. On average. So it's a long process. So I'm starting to see books with my name in the back and the acknowledgments, or I edited a book by myself for the very first time when one of our editors was out on leave.
Yep.
And that one just came out. And so just having that kind of self, what's the word? Like satisfaction of like, I did this after so much time. I totally know what you mean.
1000%. I will also, I did the same thing when I first started working in the industry at Warner Brothers. When I started seeing my name on album credits, which was about a year into it, I was like, oh, I'm doing it.
Right? Yeah.
Okay, I'm pulling this off. I can't believe this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really magical. You know, and I kind of want to go back to this idea about storytelling for a second, because I was actually just, the last interview I did was with, she was the head of book development over at HarperCollins. So this is literally, I'm going to tell the exact same story and see what happens.
Okay.
So I mentioned this a second ago. I think that you are a story hunter, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You find stories. It's obviously what your job is. And you're story aware. You're aware of stories around you, or you're starting to, you know how to do that. I tell my clients these days, I'll say, look, you know, there's stories around us that are flying around us like butterflies all day. Butterflies. Stories with a beginning and a middle and an end. Classic narrative structure, right? Tiny little vignettes. And I call them vignettes with my clients. Like just little vignettes. That's all they are.
Yeah.
You know, cute little dog. You know, I don't know, making it up obviously now, but like, you know, the opening is I see a cute dog walking down the street. The middle of it is he sniffs me. We get along. And the end of it is I am in love with a new dog. Like any of that. Then I'll tell my clients, I'll say, I want you to be story aware. Like I kind of lean in on that term, and I'll, with kids, I'll be like, story hunter, go out and find me stories next week. They're everywhere. Then the sort of the secret sauce, I think, is, at least it seems to work, is that I ask them, I say, great, now that you've told me that little story, why did you tell me that in the first place? Because now you can extract maybe a meaning from it and a purpose from it. And then maybe, and I've been working on this myself, this has been a self thing for a long time, I'm trying to extract the meanings from these little vignettes and like braid a giant narrative of my life, if that makes some crazy weird sense.
Yeah.
Does that kind of track? Like, so in terms of being a story hunter, that's what you're doing. You're being aware of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I kind of see what you're saying. I think it really, I do that in my personal life too. A lot of the time, like I'll be like, oh, this would make a great book. Or, you know, you kind of, one chapter closes, you're like, oh, that was its own story.
Right. Because you're thinking
the same thing with fiction works.
Sorry?
The same thing with like fiction works that I work on, these like the authors just found one moment, one small inspiration, and then made a whole 300 pages out of it, which is always so impressive to me.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? To just have that moment of, oh, that happened. And like, I do it all the time now. I try and be story aware all the time. And now it's just like, it's just reflexive at this point. I just see things differently. Now I watch for vignettes. And then I pull meaning out of it from the vignette or the giant story that happened in front of me if I can. If I can't, oh, I had fun.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I like that idea of like pulling meaning from it after the fact.
Yeah, it's an easier way of doing it, because as a therapist, you get driven into this idea of like narrative therapy, and it's like, what's a big story about your life? And it's totally valid. Like, you know, these narratives of like, I'm a survivor, or I'm a you know, a thriver, or I'm a victim. Like, all those things are valid, but when you can really operationalize them and kind of, I think at least, break them down into the little mini operas that happen throughout our day, like we just don't, we don't see it. We don't give it respect. And by giving it respect, then maybe you can pull out some kind of a meaning, which is usually shit like abandonment, fear, love, safety, you know, the big themes.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And that also, I mean, that's how it works in books. Like, that's how you start caring about a character, because you get either these little flashbacks of the character's life, so you learn about them through it, and that's what creates that character, and that's why you care about them. It's the same with people. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm having some fun with it. It's fun, to be honest with you. It's a lot of fun telling young kids, like, be a story hunter. Like, sell it to them, like, go get your pith helmet on, and, you know, go get your, like, these 10-year-old kids. They're like, okay, now I want you to go ahead and get your, you know, it's like Jungle Cruise ride at Disneyland. You ever been there? Like, go and get your flashlight. You can find stories everywhere. They're flying around you all day. And I'll tell them, like, bring me back a story next week. And they do sometimes.
That's awesome.
And the cool thing about it, maybe the last part about this is, and I think you're going to resonate with this too, is that the best part of this whole intervention thing I'm doing is that I get to tell them at the end. Because first I'll say, like, you tell me a story. And they always say, I can't tell a story. I'm like, yeah, you can.
Right.
Of course you can. And then I get them to do it. At the end of it, I say, congratulations, you're a storyteller.
Yeah.
Like, nobody gets told that, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, that's, yeah, I think that's really big for, especially for a kid. Because I remember the first time one of my teachers was like, oh, you're a writer. And I was like, what, me, a writer? So I think that will stick in their brains, and they'll, you know, they'll be able to find stories in anything after that.
Tell me more about that moment.
Yeah, I think it was around the fourth grade. I had a teacher that was really open to letting me, instead of writing essays, I could write short stories that covered the prompt, or a poem or something more creative, because I was just struggling with writing like a cut and dry essay. And I really appreciated that, because it helped me unlock what I was really wanting to say in a more creative way. And then now, as I grew up, like, I was able to verbalize it or to write it in the appropriate way. But I'm really, really glad that she let me do that. And I submitted an essay one time, and I can't even remember what it was about, but when she returned it to me, she's like, you're a writer. You should write. And so that same year I like won my school district's writing contest. And it was just like such a big moment for little me, because I was like, oh, I'm a writer.
Right.
Which, like, as a reader, that seemed huge, because I thought writers were, you know, so, I don't know, so respected and like these huge people. And then she told me I was a writer. I was like, oh, wow.
Right. Right. That's beautiful. How wonderful. Talk about a moment in time.
Yeah, right? She's
that's,
great.
That's when North Star lit up. That's what that lady did. Or teacher, you said? I'm assuming woman. Whoever that is. They lit up a North Star for you that at that exact moment.
Yeah, she really did, because I went to a private school for like kinder and first grade, I think. And so it was a lot of hands-on learning. So there wasn't a lot of like pen to paper work. And then when I transitioned to public school, I remember feeling super lost, because I had never done like traditional school work. And so the first couple of years in public school were really hard for me in that sense. But when this teacher sort of just let me do the work, like accomplish the same task, but in a different way that resonated with me, it showed a lot of respect for me. And I really always think about her with so much love, because it was a huge moment for me.
Yeah. And she was a mentor.
She was. Yeah. My mom still keeps in touch with her, because my mom was a teacher at the same school. So I still get to say hi every now and then.
All right. You want to hear why I have the best segues in the business? Yes. Ready for this one?
Yes.
Best segue you'll ever hear. Possibly ever, honestly. I doubt even Dan Rather could pull this one off. You ready?
Oh, I'm excited.
Okay, it's not that great. Here we go. So speaking of which, I really want to talk about you being a college advisor for the AmeriCorps group. I think that's whatever that is, and I know a little bit about it, and I do know this at least, that they say we provide choice to the choiceless and voice to the voiceless, which is, I will buy that t-shirt in a heartbeat. What is all this? I love that.
Yeah. So I graduated college in 2020, which was just a really awful time to graduate. And I did not know what I wanted to do. And I was initially planning to do Teach for America, which is also an AmeriCorps job. Okay. But I was going to move to Dallas, and it just like didn't line up for me. I was not in the right place to do that. And so I found another AmeriCorps job, which was Advise Texas. And so basically I was a college advisor at a high school right outside of Austin. And it was challenging because it was right after the pandemic. It was sort of still like mid pandemic. So most of the school year was virtual. And only a little bit of in-person at the end, but it was really rewarding work. And the goal is really to just have as many students aware of their options, and mostly have them apply to college if that's what they want, but even just making them aware of like trade schools or, you know, cosmetology school, anything that they can do to just prepare themselves for a future. That's really the goal.
Wonderful. And so the follow-up question is, what did you get out of that? What were the lessons you learned out of that?
I think a lot of empathy and just respect for everyone's different experiences, because I met with, over the course of that school year, I met with about 600 students, mostly seniors and some juniors. And each one has such a complicated story that really that got them to where they are. And the reason that they either love school or they don't love school or they want to go to college, it really all is just, like we were saying, like those little moments that lead up to who they are right now. Uh-huh. And there's not one right or wrong answer. I think a lot of the times the students would come to me as an advisor and be like, well, I don't want to go to college, so why should I even talk to you? But it really wasn't about that. It was more like, I just want to help you as a person figure out your life. Like, what do you want to do? It doesn't have to be college. So that was the biggest thing for me, I think, is just respecting everybody's different experiences and the reasons why they are where they are in their life.
You learned everything. That's what I will say. I will say this. It took me a while to figure that out. Personal disclosure, I talk about it all the time on this show. Don't care. Mm-hmm. I went through an enormous amount of trauma about 10 years ago that was just off the Richter scale. And as a result, I ended up having to clear my head. And one of those ways was working. And is this virtue signaling? I don't know. I don't care. But one of those ways was for me to work at an orphanage out in Cambodia. Phnom Penh, like out across the Mekong River. Mm-hmm. And wow, talk about service work. And that's where like it lit up in my brain, like, oh. And then I read this quote from Gandhi that where he said, in order to find yourself, you must lose yourself in the service of others. And I was like, right. Oh, no shit. Right. That's how it works. Now I'm a therapist. Ta-da.
That's amazing.
Right. But that's the thing. That's why I called this out, because I think service work is absolutely everything. Yeah. That is why I do this for a living. I'm a caregiver too. To another, I mean, this is like virtually signaling central here, but I'm a caregiver to another guy. He's my best friend. I've been working with him for like 4 years. He's just a magical human being. He and I are just best friends. Anyway, I got happier when I was in service. Ta-da. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I knew pretty early on that the job wasn't exactly what I wanted to be doing, but I'm still so glad I was able to do it, because it really was one of the most rewarding years of my life.
Absolutely. Because you got out of your head.
Yeah. And I think in such a tumultuous time for just me, like graduating college, fresh out of school and during a pandemic, with a lot of uncertainty, I liked helping other people figure it out.
Yes. Yes.
So it was great.
On the nose. You just said something interesting too. You said uncertainty. I lean on this all the time these days. Mm-hmm. So there's uncertainty and there's uncertainty and there's certainty, right? How we deal with uncertainty, we freak out. That's anxiety. Ta-da. But right. We also try and have as much certainty as possible, of which there is very few, except for our reactions to things. So what you've done is you made a conscious effort to go try and gain certainty by helping others.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's, I like that.
I mean, I'm not wrong. So moving on from extolling your praises and virtues, which on that level, I will happily continue, but I do want to move on.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in this conversation, in this next question, and I've asked it to producers. Like, I've interviewed a lot of people in Hollywood, producers and directors and script writers. You know, I've heard a lot of some of the same things that you've been saying, and a lot of agents too. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, especially in the book world too, how is technology affecting not only the business, but also the readership and the constant of, in other words, because I'm an old school guy, I like books and things in my hand, yeah. But I also understand the trade-off of, hey, convenience, and we have a Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think that lands from even a quality of writing standpoint and reading?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a huge conversation. I think at the most basic level, ebooks have been good. Like, people who read physical books don't always cross over with the ebook. And so we've seen really strong sales in ebooks for people that prefer that format. And print sales didn't really suffer as a result, which is great. But we also see we try to always make our print books, especially the ones we're really investing a lot of time or money into, there has to be some sort of bells and whistles to make it worthwhile to have people want that physical copy. So whether that's like stained edges or, I don't know, pretty end papers in the inside of the book, or, sure, you know, something to make it worthwhile to have the physical
experience
copy. So that's one aspect of it, but I'm not sure. It's interesting because I think about Fourth Wing. I know there's some controversy over that because when the first book, I think, was published, the second book hadn't been written yet or something. It was on a really quick turnaround, which doesn't necessarily mean the quality of the writing suffered. But I think with access to books at your fingertips with a Kindle, readers want it even quicker because you don't have to wait for it to get bound, sure, or to go buy it in the store. You can have it literally downloaded right then and there. Sure. And I think we'll probably see that more, especially with series books with a huge fan base. But it's interesting. I'm interested to see how it continues. I'm sure, I know my bosses have been in the industry for years and years, and they always tell me there was some sort of anxiety at the time of the when ebooks were becoming a thing, but it ended up working out really well. So yeah. I don't know. It's interesting.
It's really interesting too, because, you know, when you think about it, it's fascinating, and it makes sense that the book industry is doing what the film industry, or specifically the theater industry, is doing. Because if you watch the theater industry, what they're doing is, you're doing better seats, big box, move things, right? We'll bring dinner to you. They're selling the experience more, which is the same model that you guys are doing.
Right. Yeah. But I think people will still always, reading a physical book is just so different. And I think there will always be a demand for that.
It's a liturgy. It's a liturgy. You know, what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah, it's a whole different experience. And whether it's from nostalgia or just the actual feeling of holding a book and the sense of fulfillment when you finish it. I don't know. I feel like print books will always exist.
I'm sure they will. They're not going anywhere.
But yeah.
I think they're going to be seen more as CDs are, quite frankly, or even records. In the sense that, they're still being made, people still buy vinyl.
That's true, yeah. And it always comes in cycles, right? People are loving vinyls again. And so, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the intersection of technology and how they can disrupt things and old models. And I could talk about that for a long time, but that might be boring for the listening audience, ladies and gentlemen. So I am curious, though, actually, just really quick on this one. Is there a certain genre that is more preferred for digital readers or genres?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure, actually. I don't know the actual numbers, but I feel like it might be rom-coms. I don't know.
I could see it being even maybe on the print, but for the digital, it's interesting. I wonder what that'd be like.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to find out. I'm gonna have to look that up.
Yeah. So, okay, what is the? Not good. I was gonna ask you. Well, you can answer the question. You can pass. Completely up to you. What is the most hyped book that you don't like? You're happy to pass.
Oh, okay. No, I do have an answer.
Go ahead.
The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. I was so excited to read it when I saw it at the store, read the back of the book. I was like, oh, this is amazing. I love time travel. I love anything having to do with manipulation of time. So it seemed so perfect. And I don't know. I was just a little bit disappointed because I felt like all the alternative lives that the main character gets to live are so out there. And I see the appeal, and I know why people loved it. but I wanted it to be a little more true to life. Like, I wish it was like she ended up marrying this person instead of this person, or she took this job, like something a little smaller, but I think it would resonate with someone more, because I don't know if you've read the book, but basically the lives she gets to live are just huge. Like, she's a rock star in one, or she's an Olympian in the other. And so obviously they're going to look very different, and there's going to be consequences to each life. But I was interested more in the small changes that lead to small, like that ricochet and kind of cause these huge changes ultimately.
Okay, the fact that you just did all of that proves my point and your point that you were well on your way to the North Star, because clearly that was amazing, whatever you just said. And you do remind me a lot. You should, if you're going to go back and listen to some other shows, go listen to one for Tracy Mercer, who's a producer. She's a complete badass. I've got one of my best friends now. And she basically just said what you just said, actually. So anyway. Okay, so next question. Like, maybe there's like a round robin speed thing. Yeah, here we go. What is the best book adaptation that you've seen into a film?
That's a good one. Ooh.
Because you know my follow-up is, obviously. So think about the other one.
Oh my gosh. I am just blanking right now on movies. I don't know. The Notebook was like one of the first book to screen adaptations I watched. Yep. I still love it. I think it's so true to the book and so romantic and nostalgic. I think I really love that one.
A little hard. Also a little hard though still to know that Rachel McAdams and what's his name, Ryan Reynolds, or whatever his name is, they hated each other. It's kind of hard.
I know. I choose to ignore that.
La 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 la. I'm not thinking about this now.
Yeah.
Okay, now I will parry with this. What's the worst?
The Book Thief is one of my favorite books ever. And so when I found out there was a movie, I was so excited to see it. And I just didn't get that same feeling from the movie. I don't know. It's such a hard book to capture because the narrator is death. And so that was what drew me to it. And so in a movie, that's just really hard to capture. You kind of just get to see the plot and, you know, see the characters doing their thing. So I think that one just maybe should have stayed a book.
Yeah. It must pain you sometimes when you hear about maybe your favorite book being made into a movie. You're like, don't screw this up.
I know, it is hard. I love it now, kind of working in the industry. One of my responsibilities as like an assistant to our publisher is just keeping track of the movie tie-ins for our imprint. And so it's always so exciting to me, but I'm always so scared because some of them I really love and I don't want to see them. I'm like, no, I think this is so fun. Like, it should be a book. I mean, it should be a show or a movie. So it's, I don't know, hit or miss, really.
You're a delight. You are. You're great. Fantastic. Okay. And by the way, now I'm just riffing. I've already run through like my four questions I already had to begin with. So we're just riffing now. But I really am fascinated by your world. I really am. Because again, maybe just going back to that, the whole thing about your North Star is fantastic. Because you're going to get there, wherever that may be. I mean, maybe it's right where you are. I don't think so. I'm sure you got other plans to just keep moving with this. Of course you do. And you're going to be able to swat away all the little annoyances that come your way as a result, because you got the North Star.
That's true. Yeah, that's such a romantic way of looking at it.
I have a strange brain, lady.
I love it.
Okay, let's keep running with this. Music. Give me some music and stuff. Let's talk about that for a second. What do you got?
Oh, gosh. Music. I love Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
The moment right now.
Tay-Tay. Now we're talking.
Yeah. No, I think, well, part of the reason, not to be like so one note, but a part of the reason why I loved her growing up was just the storytelling in her music, because I didn't really see that with a lot of the music that was on the radio. And so I grew up listening to her and really appreciating that. And I had this like notebook of like, this is embarrassing, but I would write my favorite lines and like keep track of them by album. And then as I grew up, I sort of like, I didn't do that anymore, but now it's really exciting to see her come back into the spotlight and be so huge. It's just like very fulfilling for me. It's full circle.
Self-made billionaire. Good for Tay-Tay.
I know. I'm so proud of her.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've been following all this ridiculousness on the right going on about how the NFL is rigged because she's dating a guy, a 49er guy. Like,
yeah, what? Yeah. I know. there's so much controversy there for no reason.
All that is just feigned outrage.
Yeah.
Clutching their pearls and, oh, outrage. Oh, no.
I know. It's so funny. There's a song from like one of her early albums that talks about like people sitting at a sports bar, like saying that she can't sing or something. And people on TikTok right now are just going crazy because they're like, oh, wow. Like she basically manifested her life like
completely.
So many years ago. Yeah.
Wait. So what else? We got Taylor. What else we got here? Run it down.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'm really into like indie, like folk music right now. I really like Noah Kahan. He's pretty new. Like Gracie Abrams. I don't know. My music taste really changes every few months.
But as expected, and then maybe I'll close with this because this is as totally expected now that I think about this, that your music taste is all over the place. Mm-hmm. Because you're an explorer. You're a hunter. And you listen for other things. And you listen for different experiences, I can tell. And you see things differently because you look for stories, right?
Yeah, so, I think, yeah.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, with music, for me, it's less, except for Taylor Swift, really, like, I don't fixate on one specific artist. I choose songs based on, like, whether I really like the tune or I really like the lyric. So I'm really all over the place with music for that reason.
Right. And it makes sense, like I said, because also you are an explorer. I can tell. That's exactly what I'm... Well, what an absolutely lovely conversation I've had with you. The way that I like to end this show is I'm going to pretend to say goodbye. You're going to pretend to say goodbye.
Okay.
And then we're going to pretend to hang up, and then we'll do a chit-chat afterwards. Fair enough? Like a bunch of theater bullshit. You ready?
Yep, sounds good.
Okay, get your game face on. You ready? A little theater. Ready. Here we go. Okay, thanks a lot for doing the show, Christina. I've had a blast, by the way. I really have. You're great. Thank you so much, honestly, for reminding me the power of storytelling and just how and reminding me what a North Star looks like. Like, not only did you read Dr. Seuss, but you also, that teacher said, you're a writer. Congratulations. So thank you for reminding me of that. Your turn.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. I love that. I mean, I love talking about my job, but I also loved just talking about that North Star idea and kind of seeing it in my head play out. It was a good time. So thank you.
It wasn't bad. All right. So we're pretend to hang up and a one, then a two, and a pretend and click.